Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, sponsored by Bailey Gifford. And I'm delighted to have the great Griffith Jones, actor, comedian, writer, who has written a terrific article for the new issue about the horror of the long goodbye. Can you explain the long goodbye, please, Griff?
Well, I'm sort of somebody who's a little bit sort of no fuss, although I fuss myself. It's true to say that people who fuss about themselves a lot and are inclined to make a fuss don't like fuss. That's sort of inevitable. But so I like to get some of these sort of basic formalities out of them, particularly goodbyes. If it's time to go, just go. If you're at a railway station and you're waiting for a train, and the train is sitting there, and a sort of lengthy, all that stuff that goes on tends to, it's just, there's a moment where you just need to go, bye, and just say goodbye to everybody, and particularly at parties.
And you paint the scene on leaving, say, a party or a dinner party, and you're longing to leave. Dare I say it, your dear wife is not so prompt.
No, Joey's big, she loves parties, and I don't, enough parties, I think, for Joe's love them, because this dates back to the days when I used to work all the time in sort of busy sort of what you might call writing rooms and things like that. So I'd sort of had enough people, and also but Joe loves them, and when it's time to go, she is inclined to say goodbye to everybody there, and I'm inclined to just wave sort of at the room from the door and try and sort of leave. And the joke is that I shouldn't call anything a joke, but the process is that I can go all the way home, I can feed the cat, I can open the door, I can put the central heating back on, and I can come back and she'd still be there saying goodbye.
And in fact, you say the brilliant advice is when you next turn up at dinner, start saying goodbye when you get there.
This is a great way. Party management. Helen Fielding, an old friend, once advised to go to a party, always carry two glasses of wine. Because you can say, in the middle, you can always say in any conversation, I'm just taking this glass to somebody else. And so, because you may have experienced this yourself, it's a sort of something to do with the moment you find that because you are the only person that the accountant's partner has recognised at the party, she's decided that you are the person that she wants to talk to. And although it's lovely to talk to her, and I want to talk to her, but there comes a point where I need to say, I'm not very good at that either, because that involves a certain amount, not even ending conversations. So having two glasses of wine and saying, I'm just leaving, which is a great, but really nice to see you. And then gradually, as you work through the whole party, you've been there for an hour and a half saying, I'm just leaving, I'm just carrying this glass to somebody else, and then you get to the door, put it all down and go.
And it's difficult because you gave up drinking a long time ago, didn't you? But it was easier when you drank, presumably, wasn't it?
Was, I suppose. I think the truth is, the one thing that happens when you, Harry, are you a drinking person?
I am, yes, yeah. In moderation,
right.
Yeah.
No, but you're right. But those of us who sort of don't know what to do at parties, or didn't know what to do, this was a long time ago, 40 years ago now. So, we just drink and drink and drink and drink. So there was a moment where I left the party without even leaving, usually.
Yes.
People would step over me. That was the reason that I...
And so you wouldn't have had that problem 40 years ago. You wouldn't even think about the goodbye, the long goodbye, would you?
No, quite often I woke up in bed and went, whoa! How did I get here? What happened? Because all I remember was being the life and soul. But generally, as I understand it, there were some people who are, how can I put it, drunks, but they become slightly, it releases inside them. They suddenly start to say nasty things about people and things like that, which they wouldn't say. No, I was never like that. I would go in the reverse way. I was always quite a nice, jolly, very jolly drunk, and would sort of, I suppose, and then I would just pass out, and people would step over me haul me into a car or a taxi, and I would, you know, I wouldn't know that I had not said goodbye to everybody. But that all passes. That all goes back into the depths.
And I must tell you, I've talked to John Lloyd, the producer of Not in the 9 o'clock News before this interview. He said, "You're incredibly funny now, but you were also an incredibly funny drunk. So you weren't. You weren't a boring drunk."
I didn't think of that moment. Yeah, but you see, John was very sort of fatherly in my career, really, because...
Well, they're same age as you.
No, 3 years ahead of me.
Oh, which is
so
like
when
a father,
I arrived
yes.
And I was in a review in the very early stages of being at the university, he immediately left and went off to join the BBC and began his sort of breakneck sort of route through one's huge, life-changing, life of a nation, changing success after another. And I followed him into radio about 3 years later. And but John was, and it was at John's house that I met my wife.
And it was, is it right, you were working on Top of the Form when John chose you for Not the 9 o'clock News, is that correct
or
not?
Well, it's sort of, I was working on a lot of things.
No, right.
Well,
but it was your big break, Not the 9 o'clock News.
Not the 9 o'clock News was, well, it was sort of a break for everybody, because what happened at that stage, we'd all been cocks of the walk at the university, there's no doubt about that. In fact, coming to work in BBC Radio felt like a little bit less glamorous than I was used to.
Because?
Well, because at university, I'd been Lord High everything, you know, I'd been in charge of this and chairman, you know.
And actually, John said, and it's not just a flattery, he said you were the best set designer, you were the best director, you were the best actor. You could have done any of those things.
I did a lot of those things, and I used to do Footlights in my spare time. But a bit like Nick Heitner did Footlights in his spare time, but he went on to sort of, he concentrated on his directing, and me, I sort of didn't know what I was doing, and so I went off to BBC Radio, which was a great break, but they'd ended up with a corridor. Empty corridor, because all these people had joined after the war and they'd all come up for retirement at the same time, and so there was a sort of, it was a chill wind and bits of tumbleweed blowing down this corridor. And of course, it's the BBC. I mean, you can't have an empty bureaucracy, you just need to fill it up. So they started recruiting from the only place they could think of, which was Student Review, and there were only two.
But is that why at that time that much easier to have a programme made? You could say, let's try this programme.
No, in a funny sort of way, I would say it was not dissimilar. The days when, you know, let's try this programme came in were in the sort of, in the 80s. In television in the 70s, there were two channels. Three, I suppose. BBC Two. BBC Two was relatively new. BBC One and ITV, that was it. So, and BBC One had its comedy. And most of its comedy was aimed at sort of 50-year-olds. That's just the way. I mean, you might like The Good Life, but The Good Life was not. It was not aimed at sort of 16-year-olds. Yep. It was aimed at mature people. And so the Two Ronnies were their sketch show. And if you wrote for the Two Ronnies, David Nobbs, wonderful people wrote for the Two Ronnies. But they were a coterie. They were a set group of people, and they'd all made their name writing for David Frost. So it was a sort of close shop. Television, and John left. What happened in radio was a lot of new young people came in. Geoffrey Perkins, Douglas Adams were there for a little bit. Jimmy Mulville. We all became producers very quickly in this empty corridor, and we met a lot of very funny writers, Laurie Rowley or Colin Bostock Smith, or people who wrote comedy as a living, because. Radio was very voracious, and it didn't matter what shows you were doing, if you were doing weekending or whatever, it sort of sucked in writers. It needed writers more than anything else, whereas television, to be honest, didn't. Television was a sort of, you know, you either wrote your sitcom, or you maybe, if you were lucky, I think John tried for sort of 3 years to write a single gag for the two Ronnie's end bits, you know, the purple person from, but whatever, and he managed finally to get one end, but it was not easy.
I see.
So when he went over and suggested, he left the BBC BBC Radio. And I'd never understood this until I was talking to him a few years ago. And he said, oh, yeah, but I resigned. He'd resigned over a sort of contretemps with Douglas Adams and the BBC and high-ups. Anyway, he went and he put Not the Nine O'Clock News together. And he'd said to me, probably when I was drunk, probably when he was drunk, on a train coming back from Cambridge from a show that I'd been doing, that he said, you know, when I do my television show, you must be in it. So I said, great. But I mean, that was a bit like saying, when I write my major film, you know, you must be in my major, because, and then lo and behold, he had a television show. And I don't think I reminded him, but he was sleeping with my sister at the time, which might have had something to do with it. But so sometimes I joke about that. And I used to say, you know, that was the reason. And that has now been sort of added to the law of actuality. So you have to be careful.
So you didn't know Mel Smith and Rowan Atkinson. No. I haven't seen them at that stage. That was the first time
it was brought together. And as Douglas said, it was more like the Monkees than Monty Python. And so their whole set. But Chris Langham was in the first series as well. But people sort of tend to think that I replaced Chris Langham. Wasn't quite right. I was in the first series too, but not doing quite as much as Chris Langham, because Chris Langham was quite a forceful sort of performer who'd done his own shows around at the Roundhouse, slightly older than me, and so he had quite strong opinions about what he wanted to see in this sketch show that he was now in. But so did John. John, being the producer, in the end, he said, "I can't. You know, I'm not going to go on arguing with Chris about how, you know, this. My job, in a funny way, was to support him in recognising the value of all these very strong joke writers. I mean, they hung up a shingle and said, write for Not the Nine O'Clock News, and this legion of people who had never been allowed to write for television and had written either in the radio or whatever, they all started singing. I mean, I've never been in any show. The luxury of it was sitting there, and this was a freelance show, and wonderful writers, and including Richard Curtis, but Andy Hamilton and Guy Jenkins, we would sit, and we'd read through John and Sean Hardy, who was the other producer, their choice of scripts, and they were brilliant, brilliant, brilliant sketches, all of them.
Which you all added to as well, did you?
Well, which we were writing for as well. We were writing and adding things in. But this brilliant script would sit in front of us with these wonderful sketches. And John would say, well, we've got to cut four or five of these now. And brilliant sketches would just bite the dust and disappear. And in my fantasies, right the way through making Smith and Jones, I would think, if only we could get back. Well, what happened was that there was a sort of, the floodgates were opened. They did Channel 4 emerged shortly after that. And there's sudden realisation of the people who ran television that there was a market, as it were, out there for young people. And that Monty Python had not closed it down. But there's a sort of current belief for about 5-6 years that Monty Python was said the first word, but also the last word.
It would never match
comedy.
It again. Right,
it would never be. Yeah. It would never be matched again, and there was no room for more sketch comedy. It was sort of finished. The Cleese and that's why Not the Nine O'Clock famously did a sketch, you know, about the life of Python, about the Church of England.
You must remind the listeners.
I'm trying to remember how it went now, but it was the idea, the outrage of Python people sort of, you know, being sort of, I can't remember what it was, but it was not the comfy chambers, the idea that you could not take the piss.
Right.
And we did the two ninnies, because that was probably John Lloyd's revenge on the fact that he'd spent so long trying to get a gag into the two Ronnies and it was sort of, it went to town on sort of showing that there was life after Python.
And so it became a bit like it's always said, you would know if this is true or not, that American comedies have many, many more writers than British ones do. But there's an example where where there were lots and lots of writers.
There were many writers, but they weren't hired in the way that American comedies always have. I was speaking to an American writer just about a week ago, and he was telling me, he said, you know, it's all changed now that the budgets are being hit because there's so much television being made, and you know, he has to get a team together which he might have, he will only have 10 writers. Well, I think it was only 5 compared with 12 or something
right,
like that.
Right.
And when he'd done a series before, he'd have 12 writers, and that meant they were permanent. They are employed writers. They are given a salary for the duration of the show. We had a system in the BBC where we could give a limited contract to write a few minutes of a show to a few writers.
Right.
But the rest wrote on spec. And if you liked their stuff, you took it. If you didn't like it, it would just go back in the special pile.
So purely in volume, the American writers are sitting there for weeks on end having to come up with 20 funny lines a day.
When I arrived at BBC Radio, and I was working on Weekending, it was the apprentice job, and I immediately said, well, we've got all these people writing, but they're writing individually. They're writing without even meeting each other or having a sort of general sense of what the programme... So I instituted a writer's meeting, but people came... They came off their own bat. Nobody paid them to come to the meeting. We just had a room and a lot of chairs, and we sat around and said, if you want to write for this show, why don't you tell them, you know, here's some peanuts.
I presume, isn't that better to have people in a room chatting rather than somebody sitting on their own desperately trying to come up with something funny?
It's an interesting process, because if you have a series of stories which you've taken from the newspapers, you know this story, you won't be able to ignore it in a satirical show, and the writer you also know is not really a very good writer but turns up religiously to these meetings, says, I'll cover that.
Yes.
You have to learn as an editor, to find a subtle way of saying, I know, I think, funnily enough, what do you think of this story, Andy Hamilton? What's your take on it? And Andy would go, and I say, I think it's better that it's a sort of more an Andy Hamilton, Guy Jenkins job than yours, Rodney. But Rodney, thank you for, you know, offering. And there was always a mixed
blessing. And your mind must have this extraordinary thing happened recently of, they thought that Ian Hislop had been shot at in a cab in Soho, and absolutely horrible if he had been. Then it turned out that he hadn't been shot at, and then immediately
I only saw the being shot at. I think it was away.
No, it turned out there was a malfunction in the car cab. Anyway, once you know it's a malfunction, then that is almost like a perfect joke scenario, isn't it? There were jokes that Paul Merton did it, or Richard Ingram's wanted his job back, but your mind must work like that, doesn't it? If you're given a situation like that, a topical situation, your mind immediately goes to something funny.
Well, my job was to sift through things and be through writing and to edit and to go, you know, we've only got a limited amount of time, let's not allow people to keep going, we'll keep things short. So you became a sort of ruthless spook, something, oddly, because I'm just incapable of doing that these days, as you will be aware. I can't edit anything these days, but in those days, ruthlessness. Now, what my job on Not the 9 o'clock News, and in the second series, it was a more successful series because I joined with John in that ruthlessness.
You've got to get rid of the slightly non-top.
Well, most sketches go on too long, and if you look at them, you go, okay, well, it's all right, we can lose that. No, that's my fact. It doesn't matter. All the general writers that I have worked with all my life in teams, although I haven't said that, I haven't done it for 25 years, but it used to be, it was gang mentality. You know, you'd be around a gang mentality and you'd kill babies. You know, that was the thing. That's my favourite. It doesn't matter. Out.
And particularly finishing them, the thing, not to disrespect Monty Python, but they were often quite lazy at finishing a sketch. They go, that's too silly, and now for something completely different.
Oh, well, they were lucky because they made a thing of it. They made a brilliant thing of it. But and of course, everybody copied them, and then you'll just go, but now you're being unoriginal. by just saying, let's find another way. And what John really sort of resuscitated was a world which he'd taken a little bit from that, that was the week that was, although Ned was no fan of Northern Irish pop news, but he'd taken a little bit from the idea that there was a sort of world which we've all been dabbling in radio, the sort of the punchline sketch, the comedy. And John had done it with the news headlines. He'd sort of moved, he'd done it with the news quiz already in radio, rather successfully. And so he loved topicality, John. I had enough after not like news. I found the sort of business of topicality sort of became a little bit crazily easy. Do you know what I mean?
Because you'd see what the story was, then you'd make the good sketch out.
And some people very, very... and yet, listen to the news quiz at the moment, and it's sort of pure genius. Or Dead Ringers. What an amazing show that is.
Why did Ned Sheeran not like not the news? He's
jealous, pointed out, I think, I did the sketch. We did a sketch which somebody had sent in. And we did, it was somebody asking for an espresso coffee. And I came out, I was covered with stubble and looking dirty, and went behind the coffee machine and went through a straw into a cup of coffee which I'd made from instant coffee. And Sharon pointed out that actually Max Adrian had done that very sketch in Share My Lettuce or something like that at some point in the 1950s, well, before any of us, what seemed like ancient history to us.
They're pure coincidence. That sounds like he's being a bit indeed jealous.
And the difficulty is good jokes go the rounds, and we weren't in a position, because none of us had seen Share My Lettuce or whatever it was. It wasn't Share My Lettuce, but we hadn't seen it, so we didn't know. Whereas Ned, being the fount of absolute, and Ned chose the only person who said to me when I was trying to tell a story about how when I was in the Wind of the Willows playing Toad, and Michael Bryant, we were all given videos of the animals we were supposed to play and to go away and study. And Michael Bryant came back and said, "I've watched this video and discovered that the badgers." Walk exactly like Michael Bryant. And and Ed Sheeran said, no, he didn't say that. And I said, but it was me he told it.
Oh, yes, well, that sounds like a bit of a Noel.
That's a very Ned Sheeran thing, that he was the sort of guardian of theatrical anecdotes and the authority on these things, and nobody, not even the person who originally said the thing, was allowed to correct him on it. But anyway, this was, they've nothing against Ned Sheeran, except that I'm very good at doing a sort of John Gielgud with quite famous people. And he said to me, "What have you been doing recently?" And I said, "Well, I was in Funny Thing Happened at the Waiter Forum at the festival." He said, "Oh, were you? How did it go?" And I said, "Well, I always felt it was a bit like Graham Garden said, it's a fantastic, funny play, ruined by some terrible songs." And of course, I said, "Oh, I shouldn't say that to you, Ned, because you've made your life champion." Stephen Sondheim. But anyway, that was that. So,
at least he hadn't written them himself.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, tell me, Griffith, out of the four of you on 9 o'clock news, why was it that you teamed up with Mel of all of them?
We were on the substitutes bench. The world went mad because Rowan had arrived from... he'd arrived from the planet Blob. Pamela had arrived off the front page of Parade or something like that, and with more marvellous talent as well. But this meant that the two of them were sort of mobbed. And Mel and I both had been producers. He produced all his fringe shows and actors, and we'd sit there and think we're the only sane people in this. In fact, Harry Thompson, do you know who I mean by that?
Yeah.
He said, "Well, working on the show, you and Mel were the only people who weren't complete and utter." But anyway, so I said, "Well, Harry, that's the nice thing." But we were just, first of all, we couldn't see why Rowan and Pamela wanted to bring it to a close so that they could go on to their you know, I mean, it started at the same time as Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Live is still going.
funny, yeah.
We did four series, and I remember the meetings where Rowan said, I've been talking to my agent, and he's told me that, you know, it's time for me to move on. And we all sort of went, oh, right. Can't you tell your agent? But it
was doing fantastically well. It could well have gone on, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it was brought to an end because... anyway, I hadn't realised until I made further inquiries, and that was quite recently, that the whole thing was designed anyway by the BBC as a vehicle for Rowan.
Why? Because they'd
because
first
he was already,
got him?
He'd or... already caused a stir at the Edinburgh Festival, which was certainly true that Mel and I hadn't.
So you also became tremendous friends with Mel.
We did.
Yeah, yeah.
And we spent a lot of time hanging out. And in Mel, with, you know, I mean, Mel was somebody who, when we built a business together and all that, people used in the office used to say, people met Mel and got smithed. They got completely and utterly under his spell. He lived his life like a rock and roll star. You know, he'd stay up till 5 a.m, imbibing,
yep,
and partying.
When you drank, could you keep up with him?
I stopped.
Yeah.
But
you
so
didn't think
people...
he was a particularly remarkable drinker then, when you were a drinker, if you know what I mean.
I know a number of people who've been to, you know, through AA as a result of being smithed by Mel.
So charming and
so much fun.
Night. Yeah,
you know, people who would happen to people in legitimate in the record business or something like that, or people who worked in films, and they go, "What? This is fantastic! What am I doing?" They'd leave home. They'd suddenly be in Mel's aegis. They'd be in his solar system as a sort of minor planet, and think, "What's become of this? Is what I always wanted to do, and what I did do when I was a student, and here I am at last. I can do it again, and it doesn't matter." But they'd last, you know, some last a month, some last a couple of weeks, some managed a year, and then they drop out of his solar system, and they get sucked into some sort of dwarf star, and they'd have to go home and say, "Darling, I don't know what I was doing. Help me."
But he. He did it because he loved it. Without analysing it too much,
yeah.
It wasn't out of misery or anything like that.
He loved these
excesses.
He didn't want to. Do you mean he always found the idea of me having children, for example, hilarious? And why would you want to burden your life with that? But I always felt that Mel, because he never found, you know, he never found a walking hobby, or. Even a golfing hobby. He was a sort of inland sailor. And so he loved all that. And eventually, I suppose, it killed him. But what people don't realise is that Mel and Peter Cook were the closest of friends.
Oh, were they?
And Mel would go round to Peter's, and the two of them would sit there with a sporting life and various substances, a lot of drink. And they watched the sport all afternoon, you know. And then on into the night, you know, they both, you know, and they loved that. And then, you know, basically, whatever system it is, says, "You've done this, you know, and now you're 60, and sorry,
yep,
system is going to break down." And it happened to Mel as well.
But they were perfectly happy. There was no, people liked the fine, Barry Cryer was great about this, suggesting that comedians, that there's an inner misery. He said, "No, they're no more miserable than plumbers or electricians." Just,
I
you
agree.
Know, yeah. There wasn't any inner void that needed to be filled. They loved drinking and having a good time. Do you think?
I worked with Frankie, or Frank, as we called him, and
Howard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I produced quite a number of series for him, and he was, you know, he was difficult because people get. The biggest high that they can get, Billy Connolly, used to get fantastically high. I mean, why not? You're on stage, you're making 2,000 people roar with laughter. So there is a sense of what is going to be the equal of this when you come off stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of, you know, how do I fill the void that's now gone with this adoring public?
Yeah.
Or this public which I've killed, that I've dominated, that I've won over, that I've absolutely knocked dead. And that manifests itself in various ways, because it's also a tightrope that everybody knows they're on, where they all... I mean, I will remember going to an event to do a sort of after-dinner speech, and you... I just never really enjoyed them hugely, especially sort of, you know, business affairs ones, which you felt you'd arrive and make discreet inquiries. Say, you know, how long would you like me to do? And they usually say, oh, we had, you know, 6 years ago, we had, or 3 years ago, we had Bob Monkhouse. He did 3 hours. Okay, I wasn't thinking of going to do 3 hours. I was going to get, you know, 20 minutes. 20 minutes? Well, that's what, you know, I'm just checking this out. That's okay with you. Well, I mean, you know, they're expecting, you know, and have you, you know, how blue are you going to be? Well, not very, really, me. But the other thing, I remember going to one and they said, oh, we have that, what's his name? And God, he was bad. Barry Humphries, Ed and Reveridge. And he went, okay. Blimey, you're going to be a difficult lot tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
In other words, everybody, it doesn't matter who you are, you have nights where you go, that was a complicated night. I didn't work with it, I didn't gel or whatever. And there may be many, many more stand-up comedians there are now. I think every family has a stand-up comedian in it now, doesn't it? I mean, there used to be a vicar or a member of the armed forces, but I can't meet a middle-class family that doesn't tell me now that James is, you know, forging a career in the comedy business. And you go, oh, okay. Because it was such a rarity when we started for that.
And tell me, Griff, you founded Talkback with Mel Smith, incredibly successful. Was there an art to, I mean, among your productions, where the genius Ali G, the genius Alan Partridge, was there an art to selecting the ones that would take off?
I can't ascribe that art to anything but a sort of, some of it was collective, because we were artists. So we used to run the business. We, one of the reasons we set up a company is we hated sitting in those pegboard offices in television centre. And so we said, why don't we get an office? And Mel and I had made these radio commercials, so we started by making radio commercials. But we always felt that people wanted to come, and they were attracted to the idea of this was the truth about the way it was run in the early days, was that people came because they were talented, and we were there to leave them alone, not to go and say, you know, because that's what big television companies, I mean, these days, television is 15 executive producers, all of whom have an opinion about what's happening and want to express it at some point up the chain to get to the person who's at the top. And so there's a sort of sense. But comedy has always worked, and it works still for many companies, things like that, with the knowledge that if you have somebody really talented, what you want to do for them is to say, this is a relaxed atmosphere where you're going to be able to do what you want to do, and we will do, or we do, not us, but Peter Fincham will do the complicated business about talking to the suits.
but because you, it helped both you and Mel being very, very funny and very well known, so they came to you, didn't they?
They did, but we were not the people that they knew. They knew Peter, and Peter was brilliant at working with people and finding them outlets and doing things. But the day-to-day was a big breakthrough for Talkback, because Loretta rang me and said, you know, I'm looking after a young comedian called a guy called Armando Iannucci, who's done this fantastic radio show, and you should listen to it. And I listened to it, but I rang Peter and said, have you listened to this? I can't remember whether he said, I have listened to it or I haven't listened to it, but whatever happened, he did, and because Loretta actually worked in our office, was part of our organisation. It's complicated, but in those days we were a talent agency as well as a Mel and I had got to a point where we said, that almost the first thing we said was, let's not have an agent who doesn't understand the business we're in. We'll get somebody in to be an agent for us. So we set up an agency. And so Talkback was both an agency and a performance.
I see. Thing,
which, strictly speaking, some people would say that's having your cake and eating it, isn't it? And that was partly the genius at that stage.
Because you then had a pool of great talent that you could put into production.
Who you were also managing at the same time. I'm sure it's
sort of strictly speaking illegal, but I mean it's sort of, but it's a bit like the sort of it's a bit like the sort of the studio system, and you had people who worked for you and were under contract. They didn't, and it all sort of fitted together. But we also, Smith and Jones was a freelance show, so we set this up as a freelance show with no fixed writers. I wrote about 50-60% of it, and the rest of it was written by a lot of good people.
Mel didn't write.
Mel stopped writing pretty quickly. He and I used to write stuff together, and then I used to write and bring it in. But it meant that when Graham and Arthur, Linehan and Matthews came in, they started sending scripts in to Smith and Jones, and they were living in Dublin. And I said, "Come over to London and come and sit at this writers' meeting table," which we still had going for that, you know, "and meet the other people and try your hand at writing these things." And Graham always says, you know, well, it was amazing because we were asked straight into the top table to sit. But they were brilliant writers. They were recognisably brilliant writers. And so we were able to say, "These are fantastic," and sit down and write a sitcom, which they did, which was a complete failure. They wrote Father Ted for Jimmy at Hattrick, The Rivals. But then Jimmy...
They did an earlier one that didn't work, you
said. They did a thing called Paris, whatever it was.
Which was about
surrealists. Right. Which had Alexis Sale in it. And it was didn't work. So, you know, it was a sort of... It was complicated the way. But I don't want to stand here and say, I did this. I basically ran Smith and Jones. And I said to Peter from time to time, this is somebody we should, you know, we could expand, we should bring in this person and another great factual person.
Presumably it's still extremely difficult, even if you have geniuses like Armando Iannucci and Steve Coogan and Sacha Baron Cohen and brilliant writers. Presumably, even then, you can take brilliant comic actors and brilliant scripts, and it doesn't always come off. I mean, it's not a science, is it?
Well, it isn't a science, but it was a much wider field in those days. And what was brilliant about it was that Armando brought Chris Morris and brought Steve with him because they were working with him, and so they started to expand in what they wanted to do, and people. And Peter was a wonderful producer. I mean, what's extraordinary is that there were three big... It was a much wider open goal in those days. There were only three major comedy producers, independent producers. One was Hattrick, and that was run by Jimmy.
Jimmy Marvel,
who had produced Smith and Jones and been in reviews with me, is still very close mate. The other was I'm getting old. I can't remember. It was Peter Benedict Jones and Tiger Aspect, and Tiger Aspect was formed because Peter used to run Talkback, and he set up a television company under my instructions, as it were, and said, "I've set up a television company, as you said, Griff, and you know, we'd like to offer you and Mel sort of 10% of it." I said, "No, well," I said, "I thought you were working for us," in which case, as the publishers, we would say, "Good luck with your venture, but we don't, since you're actually sitting in this office." So we parted amicably, and he set that up, but Peter had been one of my closest mates at university and been in all these reviews as well. So you have these three companies which were set up by people who had all been in students, not Mel, but he'd been in the equivalent in Oxford, but we'd all been in actually the same sort of, you know, sort of shows and things.
Well, you obviously, extreme natural talent and got very good at it, and actually presumably it's very difficult, isn't it, to get the combination of brilliant funny actors and brilliant funny scripts. It's very hard to do, so it's not surprising that only a small amount of companies can do it.
Well, I guess, I mean, there was a sort of good fortune and luck in being there at the opening of this show. And not, I hasten to add, because it was a sort of old school tie thing.
Yeah.
That happened like that. It was just we'd all been working in radio, or not Peter, but I mean, anyway, when we set up Talkback, we went. Peter had an office, the theatrical presenter, Peter Bennett Jones, and we went to, and Peter Finch played the piano, and we'd all been in these shows together, and we'd all sort of been in radio and thought, well, we're going on now. We're being kicked out of radio. I went to radio and said, I've used up all my leave to do Not the Right Hot News. Can you give me some more time? And they said no. And I said, because if I want to do another series with them, I'll have to leave. And they said, well, don't come back here looking for a job. That was the actual quote.
There must have been a moment. You sold your company for a lot of money, and there must have been a moment when you were quite young, when you were free to do whatever you wanted. Is that right? So since then, you've chosen, been a brilliant actor. You're the president of the Victorian Society. You wrote a brilliant article for the Oldie about trying to save Liverpool Street. Is that fair enough characterization that from quite a young age you were able to do what you wanted, really? Combination of acting, architectural pursuits.
I probably did too. I mean, me and Mel and I did too many things, too many different things, really. I think if you're very, very talented, and I'm not, if you're very talented at one thing, you know, if you're, Rowan is sort of recognised as this sort of rubber-faced genius, you know, then the thing is, how do you preserve the rubber-faced genius? If you're competent, then I go, I'm working in, at the Lyric, and Peter Wilson, who was a friend of Mel's, and said, would you come and do a charity show? And I said, of course. And I went and did some stuff at the charity show, just some old sketches of some kind, and hosted it or something. I'd never done it before. But Peter James was there for the Lyric, and he said, oh, why don't you come and do Charlie's Aunt? So I did Charlie's Aunt, and that was a massive success.
I saw it. It's fantastic, yeah.
And it was great. It was really hilariously funny. Funny play to do, and I loved doing it. And I loved it, to be honest, doing plays throughout, because I love to do plays where we turn up and we don't have to argue about the script, because the script is already success. And the problem then for you as an actor is to find out, why was it a success? What made these plays funny when they were first done? And that applies much to Molière as it does to Charlie's Aunt. So anyway, all I'm saying is I did that, and then of course there was what are you going to do next? Okay, so we did Trumpets and Raspberries, and I say we because it was with Andrei Jasinski, another mate, and so off we go and we start doing this. But they were all sort of like I do these things and I'm sort of, you know, good enough to go on and do another one.
But also, you are in a position where you don't have to do these things. You've got remarkable energy. Where do you think that comes from? A bit behind, just beyond just sort of physical inheritance of having good energy. Do you need to go on working? What's driving it, do you think?
I've always felt... I used to have an office. When I first arrived at the BBC, I was given Charlie Chilton's office, and Charlie was a wonderful producer of Oh, What a Lovely War, and I was given a Jane in another office, so I had two rooms. It's barely recognisable, the BBC now, because people hot desk at the BBC now, but I was given two rooms, and I was 22, 21, and I used to sit and pretend to do things in the other room because I didn't have anything to do. But I got used to sort of being there, and so I've always had a work ethic. I think I went to the BBC because I was frightened about being a freelancer, and I've been a freelancer and frightened about... So I'm always going, no, I'm more concerned about what's coming next and whether I've got another job to go to, which is the sort of freelance disease, if you see what I mean. It's just, you know, what's going to happen if I don't have anything to do? So...
You'd get very bored. I mean, a good example, you're here, you are, you've driven down from Pembrokeshire, where you did a brilliant series on a Pembrokeshire farm. Not only do the series, but it's now run as a business, I think, as well. Mm. But you'd actually be very bored sitting there all day doing
that. But I'm just like any other actor. I go, why don't I get asked? You know, I've done all these theatre things. And between you and me, you know, I've been nominated four times for an Olivier. I've won two and almost got a fifth. So... Sort of, you know, you go through that, then I think, well, how come I don't get any work at all? Well, I just, they've met so many actors who appear all the time. They go, and this is an Olivier Award. And I go, yeah, wait, hang on a minute. I don't, so there's part of you, as an actor, which goes, what? Why aren't I being offered? And I've just been offered a couple, I've been offered a couple of things, which were really quite big things. And in the old days, I would have sort of gone and done them. But these days, they weren't quite what I wanted to do. And I said, I can't see myself going into this musical where I would be coming on for a few moments in the musical, however wonderful those moments are, and not able to go sailing. So I have got to a point where I had to say, this is the wrong time of year for me. I'm available to be a big star in any of your productions.
But do you find it easier to say no now, which you, 20, 30 years ago, you wouldn't have?
Yeah, but no to certain things, you know, no to long-running things, which, you know, I would like, the things I'd love to do is, for a while, I was turning up in every single film that was made, but in tiny parts, because some film finance thing was saying, oh, can you get Griffith? And I mean, John Gomper, when I met him, was so straightforward about it. He said, I've got to meet you, because I'm told that I won't get the money in. I said, well, that's very nice, John. He said, I don't know anything about it. I'll give you a tiny pot. I had a tiny pot. But I got all these tiny parts, and nobody would trust me with doing bigger things. Anyway, so there's always a sense of, well, what would we go? I tell you what's great is about 10 years ago, shortly after Mel died, I was asked to go and talk about Mel, and I went and do that. And then I thought, I want to take this on the road, because we made a wonderful pilot after we finished Smith and Jones, called Three Floors Up, which was, you know, which was really great. Just two men in an office. Took it into the BBC. And I remember Peter Fincham saying, well, there'll be any problem here, actually, because it's really funny. And I said, oh, great. So we took it in, and the BBC said, yes, it's very male, isn't it? And we said, how do you mean? Well, it's got two men. And I said, well, that's the sort of, that's what they are. I'm afraid they're two blokes in an office. And, I mean, it's just, could it be written by a woman?
This was the early 80s, was it? I mean, the early
90s. And I said, 92,000. I said, no way. I mean, well, of course, I mean, I could write it. I mean, I have written.
Not much I can do about that.
And so it was a bit like, I mean, it's a bit like, it was a really confusing sort of end of to be making comedy at the BBC. But what I'd loved was, about 10 years ago, I got up on my hind legs and started just telling stories. And I've done four shows, which I've toured around, and, you know, earlier this year I did 40 shows around the country. And that's the beginning, because I can do another 40 gigs with this show. And suddenly I'm sort of, I'm paying my dues, if you see what I mean. I do actually sit on railway stations in, you know, at 1 o'clock in the morning, waiting for that train, which I missed at 11, in order to come back into town, after having just gigged. Yeah. And that really, and I've loved that. And in fact, sometimes I meet other comedians. Hugh Dennis, you know. Peter Dennis, as I'm told, that it was great. But just coming back on the train, he was coming from Guildford, and we'd been transferred from another thing, and there we were, both coming back into town after.
And it's essentially what you were saying about people feeling, Frankie Howard after the show feeling a bit of a void. It would have been incredibly enjoyable doing the show, being at 1 o'clock at Guildford Station, perhaps not so enjoyable, but actually it's still incredibly enjoyable, isn't it?
If it goes well, it's great, and it's all like and you know, there were one or two nights where things weren't as I sorted out what that was, and so we did, I've done those shows, and I've done tours before, and as I say, this is my fourth big tour of around, and I feel this is great. I mean, I'd love to go and play the O2 or something like that, but I don't think I will. So. I won't go anywhere near the Edinburgh Festival, because I went there so much. in the 70s, 80s, like, got this thing about elderly comedians going and suddenly reappearing. And I don't want to stand in bars, and I don't want to, you know, I don't, so I don't do any of that. But, and I think there were 6,000, no, not 60,000, 6,000 comedians trying to make it at the Masque. And Professor, well, I just go, I don't want to, I'm happy enough going and meeting the audience that want to go and see me and entertain them. It's great. And I really have loved it, partly because I found with television, I stopped the producing lark because I just found it so weird that every good idea you had had to be processed by so many people.
That's what John Lloyd says, yeah.
You know, that processing left you thinking, this is crazy. I'm not the actual process. I'm spending 90% of my time and creative energy on things which never see the light of day, and I can't do that. It's just so I just went to the went to my office, I'm afraid, said, I'm not doing this anymore. We're going to close this company down, which we did, even though we'd made very successful things. And I just said, because I just feel that I'm getting to the point where I go in and people are being too respectful to me.
And Griff, coming to the end, I wanted to ask, you had a brilliant piece for the Oldie about your Welshness. As your name suggests, you are 1,000,000% Welsh, aren't you? But you haven't always been treated by your fellow Welshman as a Welshman, is that right?
I can't. I mean, it's very, very difficult. I was a Welsh actor. I was invited to try out my Welsh accent, you know, in Russell T. Davis, you know, Only Flop. And I'm sure that I'm slightly to blame for that. But I was sitting with an actor, and he said, "Oh, Griff, it must have been bad for you." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Being brought up in London." And I said, "How do you mean?" And he said, "Well, you must have experienced an awful lot of racism." And I said, "Well, to be, you know, do you know, not, no, no, I didn't. I mean, nobody, you know, there was a sort of great enthusiasm for me to play rugby and sing in the choir and things like that. But on the whole, people didn't pay any, you know, they didn't pay any attention. That's exactly what I mean. They don't care that we're Welsh."
But then you get it the other way around when you do go back to Wales. Mm. They don't treat you as a proper Welshman, do they?
Oh, of course not. No, no, no. But, I mean, I was up for a Welsh BAFTA, and I've won a couple of those, and the first one, I was trying to get into the Millennium Centre, and S4C wanted an interview, and they said, "Sylgriff, how is it for you, you know, being up against a Welsh presenter here?" And I said, I'm out sounding, but I am completely Welsh. You know, I was born only 100 yards away, and I've got, this is the land of my aunties, and 100%, there's not a drop of, and he said, stop, die, can we go back? And so they reset the camera, and he said, "Griff, let's start again. How do you feel about being up against a proper Welsh presenter?" So I was conscious, you know, that I've tried, I mean, we used to make jokes about Wales in Not the Right One, using satirical programmes, and apparently that's resulted in some residual sort of, you know, long-lasting sort of resentment of me. And but I love Wales, but you have to be careful what you say you love, don't you? Because, you know, I remember I was doing an interview with the Western Daily Mail, and he said, "What is it?" And I said, "You know, I'd never really, until my adult life, got beyond Cardiff and explored the beauty, the extraordinary, the wonder of Wales." They just think, "Gee," he said, "Oh, not that old thing." I realised that you have to be careful. You have to be careful what you like about Wales as well as what so I'm generally. I did intend to learn Welsh, and I'll have another go because I'm learning. But that was when we were doing the Pembrokeshire Farm.
Because you are in the Welsh-speaking part of Pembrokeshire.
Yes, we are. We're above the English line, you know, the
Lansker line, yeah.
And I'd learned, I thought I'll talk to all the people who are working on the house and we'll you know, I'll learn Welsh that way. And then they all came from Essex. They were all people who'd run away to West Wales, of which there are an awful lot of us. So I come from Essex myself. In fact, I'm on the latitude, the same, my it's sort of like I could, if one day I intend to walk 42, whatever it is, but I can't remember what it is, but I've never experienced anything but the warmest relationships with all the people who I know in Pembrokeshire who are Welsh. They've never spoken Welsh in front of me to exclude me in any way. And it was only when I was away filming in North Wales, and I was on my way down, my mother, and who's again totally Welsh from the Rhondda, and my wife, who's not Welsh at all, but they were invited to the celebration of the chapel, 100th anniversary of the chapel. And they went in, and not one single word of English was spoken. Complete packed house. And that was a huge surprise to me. It was like because nobody in the area would seemingly step forward to converse in Welsh, but in the chapel everything took place in Welsh.
Amazing. That's a very good place to end, and thanks so much to Griffith Jones for appearing on Radio Oldie. Thanks so much.